From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The Internal Revenue Service has files on each of us. On today's Fresh Air, we open the file on them. We talk with investigative journalist David Burnham, author of a new book about the IRS. Also today, we meet adventure photographer Galen Rao. His photos capture the beauty of the wilderness and the exhilaration of exploring it. Critic at large Laurie Stone discusses the work of photographer Cindy Sherman, and world music critic Milo Miles profiles Israeli singer Ofra Haza. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. Secretary of State James Baker says he's pleased with the results of his talks today with Soviet President Gorbachev and Foreign Minister Shevardnadze. Baker told a midnight news conference in Moscow that an alternative Soviet troop reduction proposal was interesting. More on the Soviet proposal and superpower efforts to pave the way for a successful June summit from NPR's Ann Garrels.
U.S. and Soviet officials hope to reach agreements in principle on both conventional and strategic arms control treaties in time for the Washington summit. According to the Soviet news agency TASS, Soviet leader Gorbachev accepted President Bush's proposal. The superpowers cut back to 195,000 troops each in Central Europe. But Gorbachev refuses to permit the U.S. an extra 30,000 troops to be stationed elsewhere in Europe. If that proves unacceptable, Gorbachev suggested the two sides cut to a total of 225,000 apiece. That would still be 50,000 less than the current proposal in Vienna. The question of German reunification was also discussed. While Moscow envisions a neutral unified Germany and the U.S. a united Germany associated with NATO, both agreed today the end result should threaten no one. Baker leaves Moscow tomorrow with two new stops in his itinerary, the capitals of Bulgaria and Romania. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Defense Secretary Dick Cheney leaves Washington tomorrow on a two-week Asian tour to meet with U.S. allies. Security issues and possible troop cuts in Korea and Japan are expected to top Cheney's agenda. For the first time since being banned in South Africa 30 years ago, the African National Congress held a mass meeting in downtown Johannesburg. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
About 2,000 supporters of the African National Congress, or ANC, gathered in the Anglican St. Mary's Cathedral for a historic session of prayer, poetry, and speeches. The program proceeded peacefully until it was finally over and the audience, dancing and chanting, filed out of the church onto a plaza. Minutes later, the jubilant mood turned to panic as baton-swinging policemen charged through the crowd. Women and children were trampled and several heads were bloodied by the police, who later reported one of their own was injured in the melee. It is not yet known what effect this incident will have on the ANC's future plans for raising its public profile in South Africa. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Johannesburg.
Former President Reagan has agreed to comply with a judge's order to give videotaped testimony in the trial of John Poindexter. The former national security advisor faces criminal charges for his role in the Iran-Contra scandal. Attorneys sought Reagan's testimony in hopes of strengthening Poindexter's defense that he acted with the former president's knowledge. Prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials climbed nearly 4 points to close at 2648.20 on volume of 147 million shares. This is NPR News. Romania has formed a multi-party governing council to run the country until national elections are held in May. The first meeting of the new Provisional Council of National Unity marks the culmination of weeks of mass protests demanding wider representation in Romania's interim government. Kathleen Hunt reports.
The Provisional Council of National Unity is Romania's first multi-party governing body in more than 40 years. After 6 hours of closed debate, the group agreed to match the number of representatives from the former ruling National Salvation Front with representatives from more than 35 opposition parties and minority groups, but will have to wait till they resume next week to elect a president. But nearly half the seats still belong to the front that protesters were demanding to resign only 2 weeks ago. And the three main opposition parties have again asked for a postponement of the national elections from May to December. This would allow more time for the opposition to revive Romania's moribund political culture, and it would put to the test the front-dominated council's ability to cope with Romania's economic disaster. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Bucharest.
From West Germany comes a report that Libya is producing poison gas at its chemical plant in Rabada. The environmentalist Greens opposition party said the Bonn government received information that the controversial plant, which Libya says makes pharmaceuticals, has produced enough poison gas for 1,000 artillery shells. A West German government spokesman refused to confirm or deny the report. The Food and Drug Administration proposed new regulations today to sharply restrict health claims on food product labeling. The new rules would replace a 1987 Reagan administration rule that led to what's been called an explosion of disease prevention claims by food products companies. Major League Baseball owners met for 2 hours today and afterwards reaffirmed their plan to lock players out of spring training camp unless significant progress is made on reaching a new labor agreement. I'm Sharon Green, reporting for NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As you start preparing your 1989 tax forms, you might be interested in knowing that there was a 1966 Treasury report that addressed how the government could keep collecting taxes after a nuclear war. It's quoted in David Burnham's new book, A Law Unto Itself, Power, Politics, and the IRS. Burnham is an investigative journalist who has written about law enforcement and privacy issues. His reporting on police corruption, based on information from Frank Serpico, helped create the Knapp Commission. Burnham was the New York Times reporter Karen Silkwood was on her way to see when she died in a car crash. David Burnham has concluded that the IRS is the single most powerful instrument of social control in the U.S. When he was researching his book, everyone kidded him about how he was sure to get audited. I asked him if he seriously thought he was more likely to get audited because he's written a book critical of the IRS.
I don't think so. You know, first of all, I've been a working journalist all my life, and so I've, you know, had the W-2 form and not very much outside income, so there's not much that could be done. But I want to say that it's, you know, almost every person I talk to while working on this book for the last 3.5 years has asked me that question or made a little joke about hope you have a good accountant or hope you've kept your affairs straight. And it strikes me that that is an incredibly sort of discouraging survey finding of what the American people think of their agency, that so many would make that joke that implies they think that the agency would do that, does not speak very well for the agency.
Well, let's talk about what you've actually learned about how the IRS decides who to audit. First of all, you point out that really more mistakes are corrected now through IRPs, Information Return Program slips. What's the difference between an audit and the IRP, and why is the IRS heading in the IRP direction?
Well, the IRP program is very cheap. The IRS has, over the last 15 or so years, gradually gotten all of the banks and all of the corporations and most of the any institution that's paying out money to send them records of the money that they pay me as an individual. You know, if I do a consulting, if I go to a university and give a speech, the university sends the IRS a notice that I got, you know, $400 to give a speech. The IRS takes these and matches them against my income tax return. Last year, the IRS got about one billion of those information returns, and they matched almost all of them, compared almost all of them with individual tax returns, 100 million tax returns, individual tax returns. And they send out notices if you forget or, in another way, don't put down that you got this income. And it's a very cheap, effective program to encourage full compliance because, partly because the corporations, of course, are paying for putting together the computer tapes that have the information on it. While this program has been developing, the IRS has gradually done fewer and fewer audits. At the present time, they're auditing less than 1% of all taxpayers. At the same time, they're matching everybody, and for about 40 to 50% of the population, All of their income is gained, comes from sources that are reporting to the IRS. So they're really in a position to do a complete audit of, and they are in fact doing an automatic computerized audit of 40 to 50% of the population.
Well, you interviewed the head of the examination division of the IRS, and he told you that they tried to select for audit the most non-compliant returns. Does that check out with what you learned through your investigation?
Not entirely. The IRS has an elaborate computer system that selects a large number of returns for audit. In fact, this computer system selects three or four times more returns than the IRS is able to audit in any given year. A stack is then sent to one of the 63 district offices. There are 63 district offices across the country, and then a sort of eyeball selection is made by individual agents and supervisors. Now, one would hope that most of those decisions are made on sort of experience and instinct and, you know, feeling that this is a person that really ought to be audited. But we know of cases where the decisions are made not for that reason, but for, you know, because a particular IRS agent has gotten mad at someone.
My guest is investigative journalist David Burnham, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, A Law Unto Itself, Power Politics and the IRS. The audit has over the years been used as a way to get criminals who have been resistant to other means of prosecution. This dates back to the days of Al Capone, when, you know, they couldn't get him and they finally got him for tax evasion. Do you think that it's a decent use of the IRS?
The Capone investigation was a very effective one and done against a true monster, and it worked, and it was done with restraint and, you know, totally within the rule of law. Historically, however, the idea that the IRS can solve broad social problems like organized crime or gambling or drugs over and over again has led to specific abuses of power. During the Kennedy years, Robert F. Kennedy wanted the IRS to go after organized crime and really huffed and puffed and pushed them in that direction very hard. And the IRS ended up conducting quite an extensive and improper program of electronic surveillance, eavesdropping on the telephones. The narcotics, the effort to use the IRS to go after narcotics during the Nixon administration actually led to this improper seizure and of all the assets of people who were not narcotics dealers. The problem is that the IRS, because it's such an important function, has been given incredibly vast powers, and it is not checked by the courts in the same way that, say, the FBI is. It has more legal power than the FBI, and this lack of checking leads to these occasions when the abuse has been, you know, really awful.
One more question about organized crime. How much does the IRS, if at all, still use the audit as a way of getting mobsters and drug dealers?
Well, the program, half of the work that the Criminal Investigation Division does is supposed to be, is called the Special Enforcement Program, about half of it, and is supposed to be aimed at major crime figures. They indict a very small number of people each year. It's something like about 2,000 a year. And so about half of that are supposed to be major crime figures, but the GAO found that many of the quote major crime figures are in fact peanuts.
Well, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about your investigation into the Internal Revenue Service. My guest is investigative journalist David Burnham, and his new book is called A Law Unto Itself. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
David Burnham is my guest, author of the new book, A Law Unto Itself, Power, Politics, and the IRS. You describe the IRS as potentially the most powerful instrument of social control in our country because it's the institution that has the most information about all of us. What kind of safeguards are there to protect the computer data banks with information about us in it at the IRS?
Well, first of all, there are some very strong rules saying that the tax return of every individual will be confidential. That sort of is a flat statement. However, the law then has a number of exceptions. The White House can look at the tax returns of people they're going to appoint. The two congressional tax committees can, and their U.S. attorneys can get the tax returns under certain safeguards. And that is very good. There are some many agency regulations requiring very strict computer security. During working on the book, I was leaked a bunch of what are called internal audit reports by, an agent who thought I was doing the right thing, which shows that the IRS is very sloppy in the way they apply, they keep the security around, especially the local computer systems that each district office maintains. And that a lot of that information is very vulnerable to penetration by former IRS agents, by someone who got a password. They could call in and actually get access to very confidential information very easily. There's a lot of sloppiness in the IRS's efforts to protect the computer files against penetration by outsiders.
I want to talk to you about a practical problem. A lot of us are busy now filing our tax returns for 1989, and I think everybody's experienced the difficulty of understanding how you're supposed to go about it. You've cited several studies where 10 different tax preparers are asked to fill out their tax returns for one hypothetical family, and they all come up with different numbers with, a range of thousands of dollars from tax preparer to tax preparer. One proposed solution now is to have the IRS bill you. In other words, they'd get all of your income over the year, and they'd just send you a bill at tax time. You wouldn't have to compute it yourself. You wouldn't have to understand all the intricacies of the latest tax laws. What do you think of that solution?
It makes me very uneasy that we would hand over such an important part of citizenship to a bureaucracy. The IRS, the better solution would be to simplify the tax law. We have a situation now where the taxpayers don't understand the tax law, the tax preparers don't understand the tax law, and in fact, we have lots of evidence that the IRS itself does not under tax law. And what that means is we are not a country of laws. We are a country of men. It gives the IRS just an absolute arbitrary power to pick and choose who and how they're going to enforce the law against. And the most important thing that I hope will come out of the book is that Congress will seriously get to the business of simplifying the tax law so that we, both the enforcers and the taxpayers, can understand what they're trying to do, what their obligations are.
What is the likelihood that this proposed solution where the IRS bills you, what's the likelihood that that would actually go through?
Well, they're pushing for it. And
who's they?
The IRS is pushing for it. They are gathering more, the IRS is gathering more and more information about each of us from more and more different sources. And because of the natural laziness of all of us, I think there may be a substantial number of the American people who say, hey, that's terrific, let them do it, then I don't have to bother with it. I find it troublesome, however, because, this is a time when we reflect on our obligations to government, and you sort of think about bureaucracies, which are such an important part of our life, and to give an agency that has done so poorly in accurately keeping track of its own affairs this power over our affairs, I think it's, I really think it's a seriously wrong direction to go.
Mm-hmm. You quote a 1987 American Bar Association report on tax compliance. And the report concluded that IRS emphasis on punishment ignores the role of honest mistakes. Now, on the other hand, though, if there wasn't some kind of penalty for filing inaccurately, don't you think a whole lot of people would try to pay as little as possible on their taxes?
Yes, I think you have to maintain the punishment part of the IRS to a certain degree. I feel, however, and interestingly enough, I was talking to the new commissioner, Fred Goldberg, the other day, and he agrees with this, that the IRS is obsessed with catching, you know, tax cheats and heading that off, and they spend an overwhelming part of their budget on that. And Mr. Goldberg said that he felt that the IRS should put much more emphasis on helping compliant taxpayers, you know, pay what they want to. He made the point that most taxpayers feel they, you know, have an obligation to society and they want to do it, and that the IRS itself has put many hurdles in the way. You know those surveys that show that one-third of the time when you call the IRS and ask them for information, even about simple tax questions, the IRS gives the wrong answer. You know the stories of people who've gotten wrongful notices, you know, and Mr. Goldberg was emphasized over and over again that he felt that much more emphasis had to be put on helping the, you know, the honest taxpayer pay his share, and that that would bring in probably more revenue than trying to, you know, bring stricter enforcement against the very small number of Americans who really, you know, actively try to cheat on taxes.
What other reforms would you like to see in the IRS?
Well, one idea, I mean, first, simplify the tax law. Second, try to change the mindset of the IRS away from enforcement, and make it help, 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 and then enforcement. The third thing we might think about is the IRS is in charge of granting tax exemption to, you know, groups that want tax exemption. That means, in effect, that the IRS is in charge of charity. It seems to me a good question. Does it make sense to have an organization that thinks of itself as an enforcement agency running the charity business? Wouldn't it make sense if you could devise a structure of really distinguished, you know, church leaders and labor leaders and business leaders and educators and what have you, making decisions, the broad policy decisions of what kind of charity we want to approve. And at the same time, when you moved it out, you would remove all secrecy, any kind of secrecy from the tax-exempt area. Everyone who applied for a tax exemption, that would become public. If there was a challenge to it by someone, you could have a hearing. And get the IRS out of the business of controlling charity. It seems a very bizarre thing to hand to, you know, sort of the number one police agency of the United States.
What kinds of reforms would you recommend to prevent abuses, abuses in terms of confidentiality, abuses of investigative power?
Well, one thing that has just happened very recently is that the IRS has a special division called the Inspections Division that is responsible for investigating corruption within the agency. Within the last 10 years, considerable evidence has come forth that this Inspections Division has had great difficulty in investigating allegations against senior IRS officials. A few weeks ago, the IRS announced that the investigation of senior IRS officials from now on would be handled by the Treasury Department rather than the IRS itself. That's a good beginning. I think the Inspections Division has to be increased. In recent years, the size has been allowed to decline, even though the IRS has grown enormously. And this willingness to bring in some outside blood in the sense that have outside investigators look at allegations against senior people is very important, and it's the first time the IRS has sort of done that.
What kind of grades would you give George Bush so far in the area of taxes?
Well, the new man he's appointed is an interesting man. He is a tax lawyer like many of them. But he was he taught political science and economics at Yale for a while. So he has perhaps a wider view, a broader view of what needs to be done with this organization than some of his predecessors. That's a good sign. To really get at this problem, though, I think you need a major national panel. I think you need much more intensive oversight by Congress. You need citizens that will cast off the cynicism that has led so many of us to just accept what this agency is doing. I mean, one-third of the answers they give people on the telephone are wrong. If your utility or, your department store or Hertz or Avis or American Airlines, you wouldn't accept it. It's unacceptable. And we have to, stop being cynical and saying that's the way it is. And we have to demand better service from this agency.
Where does that figure come from of one-third of the answers they give on the telephone are wrong?
That has been documented by a series of general accounting office reports that go back to 1975. And every time the GAO announced that one-third of the answers are wrong, the IRS promises that they will do something about it, and they haven't done anything about it. That gets to this question of their emphasis on enforcement rather than helping the taxpayer.
Well, David Burnham, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you.
David Burnham is the author of the book A Law Unto Itself, Power, Politics, and the IRS. It's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We want to note the passing of singer Del Shannon. Authorities are investigating his death, but they've called it an apparent suicide. Shannon was 55. Shannon's records included Hats Off to Larry, Little Town Flirt, and Keep Searchin', but he'll be best remembered for one of the great records of the early 60s, Runaway, which he co-wrote with his organist.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Photographer Galen Rao goes to extremes to capture the beauty of the wilderness. He's best known for his mountain climbing pictures. Coming up, Mountain Light. Also, critic Laurie Stone reviews the latest show by photographer Cindy Sherman. Sherman appears in virtually all of her photos, but always in disguise. And world music critic Milo Miles plays us the music of Ofra Haza, an Israeli singer combining tradition and pop. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Bush administration is leaning toward a relaxation of sanctions against South Africa if the government there releases Nelson Mandela and frees all political prisoners and lifts a state of emergency. Washington expects those actions to be taken in the near future. More from NPR White House correspondent Jim Engel.
South Africa has already met two of the conditions set out in U.S. sanctions legislation, lifting restrictions on political organizations and good faith negotiations between the government and members of the black community. An official who asked not to be identified said once political prisoners are released and the state of emergency is ended, some flexibility on sanctions will be appropriate. Though the president has some discretion under the law, the official said the White House will seek congressional agreement before taking any moves on sanctions. Asked what role the sanctions had played in encouraging the South African government to change its policies, the official said sanctions helped in the evolution of thinking on the part of the white leadership, but he argued it was not the decisive factor. The decisive factor, he said, was the sober analysis that if blacks and whites don't work together, the South African economy would fail. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
Former President Reagan has agreed to provide videotaped testimony in the Iran-Contra trial of his former national security advisor, John Poindexter. In court papers filed today, Reagan attorneys said the former president requested that a deposition be taken at his office in Los Angeles a week from today. Reagan's agreement to testify is not the first by a former president, because former Presidents Ford and Carter also provided videotaped testimony in past criminal proceedings. Reagan has claimed executive privilege in handing over some of his diary notations in the Poindexter trial. Health officials have found low levels of benzene in Perrier mineral water, and the North Carolina Department of Agriculture is drafting a health warning. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
State and federal health officials say they've detected low levels of benzene in Perrier mineral water distributed in North Carolina and Georgia, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is now testing the bottled water elsewhere in the country. Authorities say the contamination is not an immediate health threat. The FDA calculates that a person who drinks a 16-ounce bottle of Perrier each day increases his lifetime cancer risk by 1 in 1 million. Even so, health officials are taking action because that level exceeds federal drinking water standards. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 4 points to close at 2,648.20 on volume of some 147 million shares. Trading was moderate as advancing issues led declines by 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There's no surefire way to break into international pop stardom. For many years, the conventional wisdom was that imitating mainstream American pop was key. World music critic Milo Miles says our taste for foreign music has certainly broadened beyond that, but it's hard to say just how much. Milo has a profile of Israeli singer Ofra Haza and her attempts to find the ideal merger of folk tradition and electronic exploration.
In Israel, Western pop and its local variants are the predominant radio music, and have been for a long time. But several strong hybrid styles are on the rise. Easily the most well-known of the young Israeli stars is Ofra Haza, who originally migrated with her family from Yemen. In her adopted country, Haza has been a raging success since the mid-70s. Over here, she seemed to pop out of nowhere in 1987 with an album called 50 Gates of Wisdom. The record is puzzling at first glance. Haza appears on the cover in an elaborate spangled costume that makes her look like an ornamental doll. The songs are all Yemenite of a type known as diwan, which are secular and sacred tunes performed during festivals. Haza's delicate fluttering voice and her intriguingly robust acoustic accompaniment soon sweep aside any qualms about obscurity. In many ways, 50 Gates of Wisdom remains her most cohesive, appealing record. It's the one you should get first. That particular song, called Galbi, probably changed Ofer Haza's career and life. It was prominently sampled in a popular British version of the hit Pump Up the Volume by the group Mars. This haunting snippet of voice in the midst of the rolling neo-disco rhythms prompted a lot of interest, and before you knew it, Haza was hooked up with the Warner Brothers subsidiary Sire Records, and she was going international with a vengeance. That is Imdinalu from Haza's Sire debut album, Shade. Trouble is, most of the music is heavy-handed, showing an unfortunate influence from the thump and drone of acid house disco. Saddest of all, the two most interesting cuts on the record, Imdinalu and Galbi, are both remakes from 50 Gates of Wisdom. Shade was not an auspicious major label start for Ofer Haza. She has been carried at least partway back by her new album, Desert Wind. It's still plenty contemporary, with many slick beats and synthesizers, but there's depth and savvy to the layered sound Haza gets here. A clue as to why is the veteran producer Arif Mardin. If he could get the Bee Gees to sound chic and funky during their disco phase, the more spontaneously soulful Ofer Haza should be no problem.
My mother always told me,
lyrics are mostly a mixture of English and Yemenite. The English is not exactly a font of poetry. Haza should know that lines like, "I want to see you set fire to the night," are stale even in exotic settings. Desert Wind is more than a good Bee Gees dance record with unfamiliar words, though. Her songs about Middle East conflicts and Jews left stranded in Yemen are smart, dry-eyed bursts of compassion. Ofer Haza can deliver big feelings when she ventures beyond hip-shaking, and I, for one, hope she keeps getting her chance to do it.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. From Ofra Haas's new Sire record, Desert Wind, here's Kaddish.
Why do I cry at night? Why do I feel so bad? Something holds me tight. It's something in the air. I have a prayer, a prayer, a prayer.
This is Fresh Air. Galen Rowell has been described as a cross between Sir Edmund Hillary and Ansel Adams, an accomplished mountain climber with an artist's eye. His photographs often appear in National Geographic magazine, Sports Illustrated, and Outside. He's also produced 8 books combining text about his adventures with his photographs. His best-known book is Mountain Light, which was also the title of a traveling exhibit of his photographs. Rowell has said that when he shoots, he's more interested in the light than the subject matter. I asked him if the light is very different in the mountains than it is in the city.
It can be, because the light in especially high places can be through very clear air, and there can be all kinds of atmospheric effects that you never see in the city. And every once in a while, on a few days a year in a big urban area, you can see light that's as clear and beautiful as you might have in the mountains. But there's just so much more to see, so many more optical effects and all the rest that happen in the mountains and sometimes in the deserts too.
Is it hard to get the camera to see what you see?
Not if you understand light. An awful lot of the optical effects photograph really well. Rainbows just make wonderful photographs.
You have a great photograph of a rainbow. I'm thinking of the photograph Rainbow and Wild Rose. It looks as if you've actually found the end of the rainbow. The image is of the arc of the rainbow actually touching down onto the ground. Now, I realize this might be an optical illusion, but it's not one I've seen before outside of animation.
Well, what I usually try to do when I photograph a rainbow or any optical effect is not to do it by itself, but to connect it to something else, because that's what makes it interesting to us, to see a rainbow come out of the Potala Palace that the Dalai Lama lived in Lhasa. That's one of my favorite photographs. It looks like it's coming out of the golden roofs of his palace. Or to take a rainbow in Alaska and to line it up with the rose so that the colors of the pink rose and the green leaves match the colors in the rainbow, and it looks as if the rainbow's erupting right out of the rose. Those kind of things really intrigue me.
For the rainbow and wild rose, did you literally chase the rainbow to find that shot, find a place that looked like the rainbow's end?
I did. I sort of ran all over the place looking for something that would complement that rainbow, something that would make it look as if it was at the end of the rainbow and would have color and form that somehow worked with it. And I skipped dinner to do that. Everybody else in the group I was with had gone in for dinner, and I said, I'm going to hang out here with a rainbow.
There's another photo I want to ask you about. You have a photo of the first free climb up Astroman, which is a 1,400-foot rock overhang of the Washington Column. This is in Yosemite, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the climber going at what looks like it's nearly straight up on this rock mountain, and you seem to be alongside him with the camera. Where exactly are you?
Well, actually, that was with the climber who had made the first free climb, and I was doing a profile for Sports Illustrated of him. Ron Kalk is probably the best rock climber in America right now, and so rather than be a spectator, I thought I'd get the best pictures by really being involved. So I went with another climber and was tied on a rope with him, and we climbed as a separate team while Ron and his partner climbed on the mountain at the same time. But there was no rope connecting the two of us, and it had the impression that I was a fly on the wall just ahead of him.
I know how easy it is to become very self-conscious when a photographer is taking your picture, especially if it's going to be published in a magazine. What kind of reactions do you get from people who are in the middle of these life-threatening climbs, right? The last thing you want to do is distract them. But there you are, climbing alongside of them, taking pictures.
Well, that's a good point. And Ron has done it enough that he feels really comfortable. But if he's pushing something at his absolute limit, then he doesn't want a photographer there.
But those iffy moments are probably some of the moments you'd most like to photograph.
That's true. Then I would do it at more of a distance. I might be 10 or 20 feet away so that he wasn't at all consciously aware that I had a camera in his face with a wide-angle lens. And I try to be as unobtrusive as possible when I photograph climbers. I don't want to interfere with what they're doing. And if as much as I can be part of the process, if it's a ski mountaineering expedition or a hike or a run, whatever is happening in the outdoors, I don't want my photography to interfere with the primary activity that's going on. I don't want to set the whole thing up and have my coverage sort of change the character of what we're doing in the first place.
What do you take with you on a typical climb?
It depends on the kind of climb. It's sort of like asking what kind of clothes do you wear.
Mm-hmm.
If I go to something very fancy, I might wear a tux, but then if I go running, I'm just wearing shorts. And it's basically the same thing on a climb. Sometimes I have shorts and a little bag of gymnast chalk and a T-shirt, and that's it. And other times, if I'm climbing in the Himalaya, I might have 30 pounds of down-filled gear with windproof stuff on top of it and double boots and over-boots on top of that so that I can get through the snows and the winds at 26,000 feet.
Mm-hmm. Do you sleep well when you're camping out on a climb?
Actually, I sleep quite well. Unless it happened to be a night where you get trapped out on a narrow ledge and the wind's blowing or something like that. But usually you have a lot more hours of the night to spend than you do at home. You don't stay up till midnight usually on a climb, and there are no lights and no music and all of that. So usually I have a lot better sleep when I'm out in the mountains on trips than I do at home.
Tell me about a night when you were forced to sleep on a narrow ledge.
Well, I can tell you one where I didn't sleep at all, and that was a calculated risk about 3 or 4 years ago on a mountain called Fitzroy in Patagonia. That's a spectacular spire coated with ice and snow, and we tried to climb Fitzroy on the upper part up and down in one day, and we were a little slower than we thought, but the weather was perfect, so we stayed up without sleeping bags, without any normal things to spend the night. It was 0 degrees Fahrenheit, and we stood in place on a little narrow ice ledge just below the summit and sort of ran in place all night to keep warm.
Hmm.
And actually, it turned out being fun. It was very drudgerous for a little while, and then as we're shaking our arms and running in place, and one of the guys has a great sense of humor, and he started doing a falsetto Tina Turner routine, shaking his arms and legs on the ledge. And we just broke out laughing, and from then on, we had a great time all night.
You've been in some very unusual places with your camera high up in the mountains. You've been to Tibet on a couple of expeditions. Did anyone ever think that you were actually a CIA agent photographing secret places?
A couple of times, and actually I've had some run-ins with the Chinese government in Tibet, where a couple of years ago I passed a picture of the Dalai Lama to some nomads in a tent in a very remote area of Tibet. And the driver reported it to the government, and I was supposedly tried in absentia for sedition in Beijing, and I had to write letters to the ambassador in Washington, D.C., and make all kinds of apologies and say that my act was not a planned overt political act. And since then, I've decided to take a much stronger stand and not just be an adventurer, but take a stand on Tibet, where I've been 5 times, and I'm working on a book right now to come out in the fall of 1990 called My Tibet, with my photographs from 5 journeys, with quotations for each photograph, and essays by the Dalai Lama.
When you say you're taking a stand about Tibet, what is your stand?
Well, I think that Tibet is an independent nation that is now occupied by the People's Republic of China, and that it should have a right to self-determination.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think in a way people distrust photographs, beautiful photographs, and here's what I mean. You know the expression, pretty as a picture? It means less than real, you know, like too good to be true. Do you ever think about that in relation to your own photographs, which are really, really beautiful?
Yeah, that gets us into all kinds of areas. It's very easy to single out the most beautiful thing and to leave out the trash dumps or the telephone wires or any of the other stuff. And a photographer can do that. And I try to cover all the angles, but certainly if I do a book that's of beautiful pictures of beautiful places, then it has been edited out. And that is a problem. What I absolutely don't want to do is to manipulate an image away from what I see and to have any tricks like double exposures or changing colors or things that can be done with a computer to move things around in an image, because that, I feel, destroys the credibility of photography.
Let me ask you about one photograph, and this was a photograph of a cabin in Alaska, and the colors were so, it was almost, this is a cliche, but it was almost like a painting, and I couldn't tell whether this was through filters you got these colors or whether it was really like that. The Alaskan night looks blue, and the light inside this cabin looks yellow.
It definitely is that way.
Very Maxfield Parrish kind of colors.
That's true. It's a long exposure of several minutes by moonlight to get the bluish color of the snowy landscape. And meanwhile, there's the glow of a fire that's very yellowish inside the cabin that's lighting the inside of the cabin. And I really look for that juxtaposition of warm and cold light. And the edges of light fascinate me. You know, the edges of form are the most fantastic things in the natural world, where the ocean meets the land, the beaches and the waves, rather than the middle of the ocean or the middle of a continent, where the land meets the sky, the tops of mountains. Those are exciting places. And the edges of light are equally exciting, where warm light meets cool.
Well, Galen Rao, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your photographs.
Thank you very much.
Galen Rao's latest books of photographs are The Art of Adventure, published by Collins, and The Yosemite, published by Sierra Club Books, with text by John Muir. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports from South Africa tonight from the township of Soweto on preparations there for the release, the promised release, of jailed ANC leader Nelson Mandela. We'll talk with the vice chancellor at the University of Illinois about a recent survey concerning sexual abuse of women on campus. More than 16% of those responding to a survey said they had been raped. The university is recommending steps to fight this trend, including better supervision of fraternity houses. Also, a remembrance of Del Shannon, who apparently shot and killed himself last night. He was 56 years old. At one time, he was a big rock and roll star. His hit song was Runaway.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Cindy Sherman is a 36-year-old photographer who some critics have accused of being a shameless self-promoter. Sherman photographs herself in various disguises. Critic-at-large Laurie Stone recently saw an exhibit of Sherman's work in New York and says Sherman's pictures are theater, not art.
In a recent New York Times interview, Cindy Sherman said she identified more as a performance artist than as a photographer. It's an apt appraisal. Sherman is less interested in exploring what photographs can do than in using photography to document her ideas about images, how they're manufactured, how they push our emotional buttons, how they tell us what a man is and what a woman is and what beauty is and what ugliness is. Critics have called her a one-trick pony, and she is. She's mounted 8 shows in the last 10 years, all of them pastiches of popular culture genres like B-movies, fashion magazines, and tabloid horror stories. Almost all of her pictures are self-portraits, constructed with elaborate costumes, sets, lighting designs, and props. There's always a lot of glue and putty, fake noses and other body parts meant to look artificial. But even though repetition is central to her work, her tableaus are continually startling, funny, and emotionally powerful. In her most recent show, she takes on art history, transforming herself into male and female figures in the styles of painters such as Goya, Raphael, Ang, and Titian. Again, we see where wigs are glued to her forehead and fake breasts attached to her body. Through the disguises, we see Sherman, a woman in her 30s whose looks are marked by an unflinching gaze. With all the fakery, her illusions are masterful. Walking through her show is like walking through a dream. Everything looks familiar yet different, off-kilter. In the most dizzying picture, she appears as a male swashbuckler. Her face is ruddy and her clothes disheveled. She looks like she's just had sex on a haystack. Her shirt is open, revealing a chest covered with dark, curly hair. Chest hair is such a powerful symbol of conventional ideas of masculinity, and for a woman to wear it is to take a radical departure from her own gender. But the picture is more complicated than this. The man's pecs are so developed and his nipples so pronounced, his chest has a female cast to it, and his hair is long, a tangle of black tresses. Sherman has concocted an image that zooms straight from the id, that is a portrait of the id. Sherman is making theater. Her pictures are about the pleasures and terrors of fantasy, of expressing forbidden thoughts, about busting through barriers that traditionally demarc genders, classes, and races. Part of the power of her work comes from the fact that we know, all the time, that a woman is in control. The images she examines have been shared by women, but have originated in the imaginations of men. If an inscription were printed above her shows, it would read, "Now it's my turn." By impersonating the stereotypes and archetypes fashioned by men, Sherman calls attention to the subjective, agenda-filled sources of artistic inspiration, including her own. By rearranging herself rather than employing models, she makes her distortions exuberantly enjoyable. No one here is a victim of art or a passive foil. By willingly exposing the dark, fanciful, eruptive images that flood her mind, she testifies to the fact that the female imagination, like the male imagination, is fueled by an eroticism that seeks to celebrate life and by a rage that thunders against mortality. It's all there in the work. Pictures don't lie.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic. A catalog of Cindy Sherman's 1987 show at the Whitney Museum is available from the Metro Pictures Gallery in New York. Sherman will be showing at the Linda Cathcart Gallery in Los Angeles in June. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews. Our production assistants are Joan Tui and Roberta Sherrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, British novelist Margaret Drabble on domestic life, feminism, and social change. Also, filmmaker Michael Romer tells us about his new movie, The Plot Against Harry. It's really an old movie that took 20 years to release. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.